No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. We've got a special show tonight. We're pre-recording it, so unfortunately you can't call in and ask questions. And the reason we're doing this is that we have two very special guests from Europe. Let me tell you, who are in Europe right now. So there's a big time difference, and we had to coordinate our schedules to make sure that the people on the East Coast and the people on the West Coast and the people in Madrid were all on the same wavelength. So we had to pre-record this show, and we apologize to anybody that wanted to call in. But let's start by introducing my wonderful co-host, who has been gallivanting all over Europe, doing God knows what, Maria Sanchez. Happy Mother's Day, Maria Sanchez.
Thank you so much, Michael. That's probably my biggest and most gratifying role in my life ever, was to have my four children. So I do appreciate it. It's a real honor. And I have my three sons are coming over, and they're making me a meal, and my daughter's working. So that's what happens with flight attendants. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great that they're coming over. I'm not sure that my horrible children are doing anything for their mother. I'm taking her out to dinner. So let me also wish my wife, Pat, happy Mother's Day. She had three wonderful children. Who are wonderful children because of the love and support and energy that she put into making them that way. And that's also true. My mom, Louise, who was a great mom. So without further delay, let's start by introducing the two guests that we have who are with us from Madrid today. I believe they're in Madrid. One is Kevin Cunningham. And he's an MBA candidate at IE University, and also Samantha Carlin. Both these people were involved in an international conference that I just went to called the Horesis Global Meeting. Horesis is a Greek word meaning coming together. And there was a meeting of people from 80 different nations, including three heads of state, were there. And we got together to talk about the problems of the world and to talk about globalization and how we could all get together in working together to solve things like global climate change. And I've invited Kevin and Samantha to be on the show because they're young people that attended the conference, and I really want to get their impressions on how they felt, because old geezers like me will be retiring soon, and it'll be up to them to make a better world. So without further delay, let's bring on Kevin. Kevin, how are you? Are you with us?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Senator. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And Kevin, you went to the meeting, and you were there for the whole, like, 4 days. Is that right?
That's correct. I had the opportunity to attend the conference on behalf of my business school, IE, like you mentioned. IE sponsors the event every year, and they bring along a few students that are club coordinators at the school to take part in the conference and to give our own input from, like you said, our younger generation's point of view.
And first of all, tell us what IE University is. Go ahead.
IE is a business school in Madrid, Spain. It's frequently ranked in the top 10 business schools worldwide, and this year was ranked number one for being the top business school for entrepreneurial spirit and mindset. So it's a very fast-moving, forward-thinking business school that brings together nationalities, various backgrounds, and work experience all together to develop a new type of business leader for the future.
Is the curriculum, Kevin, in Spanish?
No, they have a joint program. So I'm attending a session that's all in English. A majority of the business school is in English, and then they do have different sections in Spanish.
So you didn't have to be bilingual to be able to attend?
No, my Spanish was very limited, but it's all in English.
That's what a relief that is. Now, it's interesting. My eldest son graduated from the University of Southern California, USC, from the Marshall School of Business in Entrepreneurial Studies. And I didn't know that there was advanced degrees in that.
Sure. So it is an MBA program, but their focus here is bringing together cutting-edge technology and a new way of thinking in an entrepreneurial spirit using traditional MBA classes and skill sets. So it is an MBA, but it is very focused on an entrepreneurial mindset.
How fabulous.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's very interesting about the Horace's meeting. There's lots of entrepreneurs there. Lots of entrepreneurs, more entrepreneurs than there are what I would say. Well, there's government people and entrepreneurs, basically. They're not like people from established businesses. They're not people from General Motors and places like that. They're people that are doing startups and they're doing amazing stuff around the world or have created their own business. So, first of all, I would say to you, Kevin, what a great opportunity for you. I'm sure you made a lot of great contacts there. And do you want first, let's talk about the conference. What was your impression of it? What do you think of it? Do you think it's a great I think it's a great idea. I think it's the conference of the future. And I think someday people will be talking about this as if it was the beginning of a worldwide movement. What do you think?
Sure. I very much appreciated the opportunity to attend. And I agree. I think this type of conference is necessary, especially for someone like myself, a young MBA student who is going to be a leader of the future. And we need to discuss how we got to the situation we're presented with right now. And I thought that the topic of the conference, which was catalyzing the benefits of globalization, was very, very keen for our current political and economic situation that we find ourselves today. I felt that the discussion around the latest trend to support and prop up populism, well, we have benefited from globalization, was very, very on point and created a great conversation along the lines of what motivated different countries and cultures to go against what traditionally has been the projection that the world had been going in the past 50, 60, 70 years. So I very much appreciated hearing the interest, the opinions, and the experience from, like you said, a lot of leaders who come from non-traditional backgrounds but are very much key players in today's society.
Do you have to be invited to attend like you were, Michael, or and Kevin, you as the representative of IE, or can anybody attend?
No, I think you have to be invited. I've always been invited to speak, so I've been actually part of the organization. They actually pay for me to come and be part of things. But I think you have to be invited. Although they're very open people, I'm sure, you know, if you said, I'd really like to attend, you might very well get an invitation.
How do you spell it, the name of the conference?
H-O-R-A-S-I-S. And again, it's a Greek word meaning coming together. And that's what this is all about. It's about bringing political leaders and business leaders, and thank God, young people like Kevin, together to talk about these problems in the hopes that we can move the ball forward on bringing the world together and working together. You know, things like, I think that everybody over there agreed that things like global climate change are not things that any country can resolve. We need to work together to resolve those things. And so that's what the conference is about. I think it's a great conference. Really.
Well, having just been in the United Kingdom, Brexit is all over. I would imagine that there had to be some conversation about Brexit at this event.
Yeah, it was one of the main conversations, wasn't it, Kevin? Did you hear a lot about? I heard a lot about it. How about
yes,
you?
Yes, I do. I do feel like Brexit was very much at the forefront. We had a few politicians from the UK that were in favor of Brexit, but a majority of the conference was not just against the concept of Brexit, but against what the principles were behind it. And I think those were the same principles that everyone was focusing on understanding, because those are the same principles that have led traditionally progressive countries to almost take a step backwards on the progress they have been able to achieve over the last decades.
Yeah, and that was certainly the question that I got over and over again, was about populism in the United States as opposed to or compared to populism in England and Europe in general. There were several countries that were following along the lines that the United Kingdom was following, Italy, for example, and the Netherlands and France, but they've all kind of backed off the whole Brexit, idea. So there seemed to be some optimism that populism was not going to steer the ship of state for all these countries in the future. But yeah, it's a major concern. It was the one thing, as Kevin said, we both heard a lot about it over there. And there were several people from the UK, some who embraced it, but many people that I talked to anyway were against it.
Well, I spoke with two women when I was in London at the conclusion of my trip, and they kind of, the foreshadowing to me from what I gained from them was, they said, first of all, it's 50-50 people wanting to Brexit or not. So it's not wildly popular because it's not a decided majority. And then this one woman said, but the worst thing for me is what we're leaving to our children, the legacy that we're going to leave to them, because it's not really going to be our problem. It's going to be their problem. And I thought that was really poignant. And then when I was in Belfast, because Northern Ireland identifies with the UK, so if Brexit happens, Northern Ireland is leaving, but Ireland won't. Ireland is part of the EU, and they're talking about a wall and separate countries, and, you know, similar to what I guess happened back in the day, and it sounds terrible.
Well, and you know what? I made the point when it came to the United States, and we talked about populism, that it was hard for us because we had at one time, you know, with Kevin's talking 50, 60 years ago, we ran the world. We really did. We were the most powerful economy. The next 10 economies in the world combined were not as powerful as the United States economy. The military, we were the strongest military country by far. And so the idea of globalization to Americans is something that, as Kevin said earlier about connecting the dots for people. We really need to do that. We really need to educate people around the world why globalization is a good thing, because it's hard. You know, we're used to being the big boss, And so I just was on Russian television, and that was the question, one of the questions that was put to me. Do I think the United States, China, and the Soviet Union can, I'm sorry, and Russia, I keep on calling the Soviet Union, and Russia can come to some kind of trilateral agreement? And my answer was, I hope they can, but it's not looking good these days. You know, what do you think, Kevin? You think that we can get along with the rest of the world okay? Are we doing our part?
Sure. Well, I think there's two different sides to this answer. One, not only should we, but it's necessary. Like you mentioned before, some of the issues we're facing today are not going to be solved by one nation, are not going to be solved by one group of small people. It's going to be solved by collaboration with the best minds in the world, the best business minds, the best environmental minds, the best military minds. And that's not always in the United States. It comes in places that we don't typically imagine them to come from. So do I think that needs to happen? Yes. Do I think it's happening and we're doing a good job about it? I don't think so. I think if you look on the news today and you see what's mainstream, it's talking about the divisions we have. It's talking about, destroying bridges that have been built over time or completely disregarding bridges that we built over time in favor of bringing back a glory day or a quote unquote glory day where there was no competition, where everything was done back home in the United States because we were the only option. Now that we have other options on the table and we have more people to ally with and to collaborate with, it's of the utmost importance to bring them on board and work with their expertise and intelligence.
Well, you know, I agree with you. And one of the things that I like most about the Horace's conference is that it's bringing business leaders and political leaders together. I was an entrepreneur. I started my own business. I had a business for 25 years that was pretty successful. And businessmen very often feel that they have an adversarial relationship with government. You know, that we're not partners. We can't be partners with government. We have to worry about the IRS, and we need to worry about government regulation, and we need to. So this idea that there can be a positive partnership between government and business, to me, is really important and something that we really have to strive for. Maria, you got anything to add?
Yes, I'd like to ask Kevin, is your class and the school international?
Yes, of course. I'm in a class of about 275 students, and we have students representing over 65 different countries.
So that must be stimulating to get different perspectives firsthand from different countries.
It really is. And it's one of the reasons why I chose IE Business School is because it offers something that a lot of American business schools don't offer. And it's not only the diversity when it comes to different nationalities, but to be in a work group, for instance, my last work group of seven people was seven people from different countries and four different continents and very different backgrounds. And when you discuss a business case from Harvard or Stanford or our own business cases here with a group of people like that, the outcomes are much different than you would expect just studying in the United States with maybe a half a dozen or so nationalities represented. So going back to the senator's point on collaboration to really make change in the future, it's only going to happen when we expose the younger generations and we expose everyone in the education system to different ways of thinking, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's reality. And if we're going to move forward as a united world, we have to be able to understand where people are coming from.
You know, that's such an important point. I mean, I can't overemphasize how important what you just said is, Kevin. When I was in college, just to give you an example, when I was in graduate school, I had a Soviet professor, and visiting professor, and we all got into a discussion about the First Amendment and freedom of the press, which, you know, Americans hold dear, right? That there needs to be a free press. And the Soviet professor was flabbergasted. He couldn't believe that we believed in freedom of the press. He said, what right do you as an individual have to criticize the government when the government is the collective of everybody? You know, what gives you the right to stand? I mean, we just couldn't believe it. So things that we take for granted as principles of how we operate are not necessarily taken for granted by other people around the world. And we really do need to understand that. And we'll never come together until we do.
One of my brothers went to the London School of Economics for his master's degree. And Kevin, it was similar in that they accept only X amount per country per year, so that they are completely diverse and international for that very reason. So, and he's still friends with his classmates. He went about 20 years ago. And as soon as he graduated, a company in London hired him to be their CEO, and he now owns the company. So he did really well by it. So good luck with your future. Obviously, is very, very bright.
Yeah, that's part of me. Now that I know that it's such a good school, I'm really going to be nice to you, because you'll be a rich entrepreneur before we know it. But as great a guest as you are, can we talk to Samantha for a minute? Because I got to tell you, I met Samantha at a dinner in Qashqai, where the meeting was, and she was absolutely charming. And not only that, I think what she does is just really, really interesting, and I really want to ask her about it. So do you mind putting her on the phone?
She's right here.
Samantha Carlin, diversity and inclusion consultant.
Yeah, what does the diversity and inclusion? I remember saying this to you, Samantha, that I had two daughters, and that I had no idea what you do. What do you do? Tell me.
It's the latest and it's the greatest, and I'm so glad, Samantha, you can share with us what it is that you do, because it's super important, and I'm so glad that entities are realizing how great diversity is and how it makes the whole part better with that. So thank you.
Absolutely. So I work with organizations and schools and enterprises to basically understand how to recruit a more diverse workforce, how to maintain diverse talent, and how to create an inclusive culture, which basically helps diverse talent to succeed, whether it is, you know, a Latino man, a Black woman, or somebody, you know, international from like a low-income country. So I think it's also enabling a culture of diversity of cultures to thrive, as well as diversity of race, gender, class, socioeconomic background, et cetera.
And LGBTQ.
Absolutely. And LGBTQ, yes.
And let me ask you, Samantha, what kind of background do you have to get into this work? I mean, what did you study in school? What prepared you to do this sort of thing?
Sure. So my master's degree is from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. And they actually are the first graduate school of IR to have a gender focus, that you could actually specialize in looking at gender analysis and international studies. And the concept of gender analysis is that basically whatever you're looking at, whether it be a humanitarian crisis, response to a war, or recruiting strategy or marketing strategy, men and women and now LGBTQ kind of coming into the mix all have different needs. And you have to target populations that... So the reason that gender is always perceived as women, and it's not, is that for so long the norm has been male. So whether it's, you know, the car seat that you have in the car, or it's your... your airbags, or it's the height of a seat, like all of those things were developed around male norms. So the reason gender ends up being seen as women is because we're just starting to say, hey, what about women? This was clearly designed for men, whether it's a workplace or a chair. So So it's really looking at the needs of men and women differently and trying to figure out how to meet those needs and recognizing that we're really operating under a kind of heterogeneous male environment and, homogenous male environment, and how do we diversify that?
Well, you know, we just saw a great example of this, didn't we, with NASA, with not having enough space suits to send a woman into space because we design it for men. Well, I got to tell you, I think what you do is so cool. I don't know how you got involved, but I think it really rocks. And let me ask you, what did you get out of the conference? What kind of, you were involved in a couple of the presentations. Tell us about that.
Sure. So I spoke on two panels. One was on diversity and inclusion, and one was looking at the Me Too movement and kind of the after effect of the Me Too movement. One thing that was exciting to me was that even though the Me Too panel was at 7:30 a.m., it was packed. It was like standing room only. And so that was pretty shocking. And I think illustrates how many people have really understood that this is not, that this is just the beginning, that the Me Too movement is not ending anything. It's the beginning of something really, really huge, and major changes are going to start happening, I think, now, but in the next couple of years, to really create environments where people are not sexually harassed and assaulted, and leaders go unpunished. So that panel I thought was exciting because everybody had a different perspective. And also you hear about so many people that have horrible experiences happen to them and the injustice that they face. It's so personal for so many people. And I think that's one of the powerful things about the Me Too movement is that everybody is now realizing that someone that they know, at least one person that they know, has been assaulted, harassed, raped. And that's pretty powerful. You can't step away from the problem and pretend it doesn't exist. And that's all over the world. It's not just limited to one country. You know, I think it was encouraging how many people were interested. The diversity and inclusion panel was a little bit, so something that I found a little bit weird about the conference and slightly upsetting was I felt like there were some business leaders there who, though I appreciate them coming to this conference and trying to engage on these issues, we just didn't seem to have like been totally apart from any sort of social impact their entire lives.
What? No, Samantha, how did you get that impression? Was it by ignorant statements that they were making?
Yeah, like a gentleman on my panel on diversity and inclusion told a long story about how he had, and he's on a diversity and inclusion panel, he had a man and a woman candidate for a job, were both equally qualified, and the woman who was more loyal and had been there longer, but he picked the man. And he couldn't understand why that was like not in support of diversity and inclusion. He thought it was merit-based and like it was very, and he was the head of a big bank in Latin America, I think. There was another guy, actually the panel, I think you were at, Senator, as well, who it was on social entrepreneurship, and he said something like, well, all companies are social because they give people jobs and because, you know, ultimately they're developing certain areas, like even if it's a mining company, or they talked about companies that are totally environmentally have horrible impacts. And he somehow thought that they were socially minded, social entrepreneurs, whereas they're operating solely based on profit. And only now are companies starting to kind of understand social impact and put it into their strategy. So that made me a little worried because I'm just thinking like how many business leaders are not being educated enough or exposed to the impact that they have on the world, on the environment, and on people, and how many of them are actually being taught or encouraged to prioritize societal well-being as much as they prioritize, you know, short-term shareholder value appreciation.
That's well, a beautiful example, and I'm horrified.
Well, I got to tell you, Samantha, it really is a matter what you're doing is really a matter of education for men, because I've worked around women all my life. I've never had a woman complain about anything that, you know, any inappropriate behavior. And when the Me Too movement started, I could not believe the visceral reactions I got from women that I knew. I mean, even my wife, my daughters. You know, they were, it just surprised me that they were so, I don't know the right word for it, upset about what was going on. And it was a wake-up call to me because I guess, you know, I worked for a women's shelter and I read the first national report on domestic abuse cover to cover in America. And I was shocked by the statistics. But for some reason, it didn't sink into me that this affects so many women. And I can tell you, there are many women in my life that have either, that I didn't know about, that have either been affected by this or have somebody very close to them that's been affected by sexual assault or inappropriate behavior or, you know, whatever, because the reaction to it has just amazed me. So I don't only think what you do is cool. I think it's really, really important. And just as Kevin said about trying to understand the perspective of people from different cultures and different backgrounds, the way they were raised, I think we need to do that also with the different perspectives that men and women have on the world. And so I think what you're doing is really great.
Well, and Samantha, as I mentioned before you spoke, it's on my radar too, because when I finish with my PhD in media psychology, your field is one that I'm very interested in, as is the chief ethics officer position that's starting to pop up in places, because companies are now realizing that they don't know what they don't know. And if you don't bring the diversity to the table, you don't know how to have even the conversation to attract it, which is why they need guidance. But I think it's, for me, it's kind of a glass half full thing. Is yes, it's been a problem and it's been one for decades, but finally the conversations are starting to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they are starting to happen. And I think that people are taking it seriously. And what's really also cool to see is, you know, as much as I want someone to hire me to come do work for them too, we're starting to see women organize on their own. I'm pretty sure with Nike, a bunch of women came forward. They did a survey by themselves to see like how many women have been sexually harassed or assault within Nike, and then came forward and kind of put that on the desk of the CEO and said, hey, check out what's happening here. And so I think organizing, you know, as a political campaigner as well, organizing is really key to all of this. It's building movements, whether it's within an organization, and you're seeing women who have, and even men who have nothing to do, their role is not, you know, head of diversity inclusion, they're starting women's working groups and mentorship programs, and more pipelines to get, you know, minority candidates in. So I think it is becoming more the norm. The most important thing, though, is that it's not seen as a checkbox, that it's not seen as, because I think that's what was demonstrated with the past, is that, you know, whatever sexual harassment training that organizations were doing, they weren't really doing a whole lot. So, you know, the most important thing about diversity and also sexual harassment training is that it's not just a checkbox, like, okay, we have a, you know, someone doing diversity inclusion, which that person should have an entire team, but it's from the top down. There's the person at the top is really invested in this and understands that it's not just like a nice to have. It's also a business imperative, because diversity breeds more creative thinking, mm-hmm. higher profits, mm-hmm. and the fallout from having things happen where, you know, women are assaulted and then they blame their accuser and they get fired instead of the accuser, or, you know, the things that happen with Uber. Like when those things come out, like they ultimately do affect shareholder prices, and there are huge public relations scandals for companies. So I think it's really important for a long-term thinking about business profitability as well as it is something important for society.
Well, let me ask you this question. I hesitate to ask it because there has been such a visceral reaction to this, but one of the people that I know and support is Joe Biden. And Joe Biden recently came under attack for hugging, for too much hugging. And my reaction to that was, if we worry about people that are hugging, are we obscuring what the real problem is, which is, you know, sexual assault, you know, women still making 80% on the 80 cents on the dollar, the Equal Rights Amendment still not ratified. What do you think about that? Or do you think my daughters call me a Neanderthal for having that position, by the way?
I mean, I think a lot of the stuff about Joe Biden is really not about the hugging. It's about the way he treated Anita Hill, you know, 28 years ago in that hearing, and looking at that in comparison to the Kavanaugh hearing this year. So, you know, I really think it's less hugging and more the belief that, you know, maybe inappropriate hugging is a result of thinking of women as property.
I would agree with you.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you another question. What are we doing about women? What are you doing to educate women? Because, you know, if I'm a misogynist, like my daughters swear I am, I was totally raised by women. I didn't have a male teacher until I was in college, I think, you know. So if I was raised a misogynist, women were part of my upbringing. What are we doing to educate women? You know what I mean? So what are we doing?
So I do empowerment workshops with a lot of different women from different countries, especially younger women. And they're really to help them step into their power and to be confident, to be able to speak, you know, to be able to be good public speakers and present well. But I think more than just that, you're also saying that women can be part of the problem. And I think that is like super important to realize. Like, one thing that I find super upsetting as like a young, ambitious woman, you know, I've worked in a couple different fields, is senior women who don't support kind of younger, ambitious women rising. Go through what I went through mentality and actually sabotaging. And this happened personally to me and to several of my friends. They're sabotaging younger women who are kind of rising stars instead of empowering them. That being said, there's plenty of women that absolutely are empowering. But I think that's why it's important to not just say, okay, yes, absolutely have to work with men, but also that women need to look at themselves and say, just because I believe in women's empowerment doesn't mean I'm practicing women's empowerment. And so even on a personal level myself, like whenever I have people that are women that are under me, I take everything that I can do to possibly empower them. I help them do strength training and personality consulting, and I bolster them up. I help them with things. I give them job advice. Like, I recognize that they're at a disadvantage just because of their gender. And so it's really important that women who are leaders within organizations, like, it's not just putting women at the top of organizations that's going to help. It has to be women that are committed to helping other women. And sometimes there's a backfire mechanism. If there's only one or two women at the top of an organization, they feel kind of like they have to agree with the men and not stand out. There absolutely needs to be huge education of women as well. And it also, it goes down to the granular, like in some Latin American countries, guess what? The gang members get all the girls. So because they have power and money and, you know, prestige within their communities. So like, what does a young man want to be when he grows up? He looks and he sees that all the gang members are getting girls. I want to be a gang member. So that's also like how women play into it too, is by picking men as partners or kind of salivating over men who are not too savory. And so that's important to look at too.
Well, so Samantha, I'm sorry, Michael. I'm disheartened to hear that you have found prejudice, if you will, from women towards you, because I came from an era where there was tokenism with, I've had several careers where I was the only woman in the room or in the building. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, because it was tokenism, women weren't as helpful to one another because they saw it as that might be their loss. You bring in another woman, then you're going to be out the door because we can only have one at a time kind of mentality. Whereas now, especially with Sheryl Sandberg doing the lean in thing and trying to get women on top. Michael knows this. I'm not about government legislation. I think less government is better. But California, and she's our local legislator, introduced a bill that became law that out of publicly held companies, 20% have to be women on the board. And that had to become a law in order to get 1 in 5 women into a boardroom, which is pathetic. But it needed to happen because it wasn't happening organically on its own.
Well, you know, yep. the more women you get, the more women you will get into these positions. You know, I was just going to say something about my sister. My sister graduated from a Washington, D.C. law school, George Washington University, which now graduates more women with law degrees than men. But when she graduated, this is my older sister, she was one of 3 women. Mm-hmm. And she became a partner in a law firm. And I always remember that my sister was like one of the most down-to-earth people in the world. But every year, this was a big law firm, 75 lawyers. Every year, she would get invited to the secretary's luncheon. And she would always send something very nice to the secretary's luncheon, you know, because it was kind of a potluck thing. She would always get some gourmet dish and send it, but she would never go. And I asked her about that one time, and she said, none of the boys go to the secretary's luncheon, and if I want to become a partner, I've got to act like the boys. And she did become a partner. You know, so there was a lot of that pressure has been there for a very, very long time. And it's very real. So,
I just had it 6 years ago. When I started my education, I resigned from everything. And one of them was Rotary. But I was, you know, Rotary didn't accept women until it went to the Supreme Court, which was just a little over 20 years ago, if you can believe that, Samantha. And it's a service organization, you know, and they still were only taking men in. But I was in a committee meeting, and I was the only woman in the meeting, and the chair of the committee looks at me and he says, Maria, will you take notes, please? And I thought, why did you pick me? And it went right back to that I was the only female in the room. And I'm like, I don't do secretary. Yeah. I'm not a secretary. I was so offended. How dare you?
Even Neanderthal that I am, I would have never made that mistake.
I mean, you know? Really?
I mean,
good for you. And I think part of it, too, is I just wrote this article, How to Become a Female CEO. Part of it, too, of doing women's empowerment trainings is also teaching women that they don't have to lean into everything. Like, that's the negative backlash of the lean-in movement. You have to do everything. Like, no, like, there was a woman telling a story about how she was a lawyer and how her assistant asked her, like, do you want me to teach you how to do your own timetables? And she was like, no, it's your job to do timetables. And then she went and questioned all the women that were in high positions in the firm, and they all did their own timetables. And some of the men didn't even know they had timetables, let alone do it themselves. So, you know, and also there's research that shows that women are more likely to take on tasks that are not only to take on tasks, but to be assigned tasks that are like non-promotional tasks, like planning the holiday party. And men are more likely to be tasked with something that's revenue earning, but women are also more likely to volunteer for it or like to feel bad, like, oh, well, I don't want them to have to do it, so I'm going to do it, you know, and to take on like the burdens of the house and think they have to be super mom and super woman at work. And like, no, like sometimes like don't do your own cleaning, like hire a cleaning lady if you can afford it. Like, you know, if you can afford childcare, like utilize childcare as much as you can, like lean on people. Don't be afraid to ask for support. So I think that's all of that. You know, yeah, delegation is really, really important. Not feeling bad and like, you know, because of lean in, we have to do everything and we have to do it all really, really, really well, or there's something wrong with us as women.
Well, and that gets back to education. I should tell you that I got my master's degree. When I got my master's degree, my thesis was I did a study, an occupational study of women. I studied 258 women in the workforce, and I found that those that were most religious were the least successful. And the reason for that, according to my hypothesis at the time, was women that, you got to remember this was 40 years ago, women that were brought up under more traditional upbringing, that they believed more in traditional what we would have called traditional values were less likely to be successful in the work world. And I found a correlation between professional women and non-professional women. And it's funny, my favorite story is that I have a dear friend who's maybe the smartest human being on the planet, and she's a doctor, she's an oncologist, and she's in our church, and she did a reading one day, and a guy walked up to her at the end of the mass and said, "Wow, you read really, really well." And she looked at the guy and she said, "Yeah, I was in the advanced reading group." And when I said to her, "Well, that was a little rude, Karen," she was like, "Look, I'm a doctor. The guy's amazed that I can read. I got through medical school, and it surprises him that I know how to read." So I always think of that. But yeah, there's a lot of education that needs to go on. How many people are in your position? Is it an unusual position that you hold? I mean, are there a lot of women doing this in companies around the world these days?
I mean, there's women and men, because it's not just about right. gender, right? It's also about looking things intersectionally. So race, socioeconomic class, like you were saying, LGBTQ. So I think it's a lot more organizations are trying to hire people to do this. What needs to make sure happens is that it's not just focused within HR. Like, okay, right. we need, quotas of we need women, we right. need, some African Americans, we gotta look good. But it's integrated like into everything, right? Like into, you can have a gender lens when you're looking at investing practices. I also think that I'm really curious about the integration between social impact and also diversity and inclusion, because I also think that companies need to have a social impact lens. And I think once you start to operate with a lens of inclusion, you start to also look at social impact as well. So the challenge is not to have it be siloed within human resources, and sometimes human resources isn't taken that seriously, to have it really be an overarching theme and something that's practiced from the programming and investment decisions of an organization to who you hire and promote.
Which is why the position should be, if it's not, is in the C-suite. Because as you mentioned right. earlier, it has to come from the top. You can't just talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. And if you're not in the C-suite, then you don't get the respect or you don't have the power that you should have to do what it is that you're trying to do, which is diversity and inclusion.
Yeah, exactly. And it has to go further than, some companies say, "Oh yeah, we want to do an implicit bias training." Like one implicit bias training, great. Like it'll help people get a little bit of insight, but it's not really going to do anything long term. Like this needs to be like sustained work that right. creates behavior change right. is really difficult. And so that's also why it's important that you have people within these roles that actually have like the academic rigor and research background to understand how to do this versus just people who have like risen in the ranks within HR and now like, "Oh yeah, I care about this." But, really getting people with expertise is really important.
Well, and I imagine that it's tough to justify cost-wise because it's not something that you can say, "Look at what we've done. We've generated better revenue because we have better retention, because we have higher morale, because we have diversity and inclusion." So I can see where it gets dicey that, the bottom line profit, well, is this going to make us more profitable? Well, ultimately, yes, not short term necessarily, because of what you just said, Samantha. It's a muscle that needs to be exercised, and you don't just do that once.
Well, Samantha, let me just say it's been great to have you on the show. I don't know where poor Kevin has gone, but I want to ask both of you this question. Is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't asked you?
Oh, I'll
anything
give the
you want to add?
I think I've monopolized most of the conversation.
Well, you haven't. It's not, you shouldn't feel bad that you're that charming, but you really are.
Intelligent would be a better word.
And actually, obviously brilliant. And so is Kevin. So let's hear what Kevin has to say before we go.
Well, I would say one that I think, I very much appreciate that you gave Samantha more time, because I think her message is very important in reference to what we were talking about at the conference. And I guess one last word I would like to say is, for our generation that is inheriting a world of environmental destruction, of complete inequality when it comes to income, of a world where a lot of the future is very unknown, it would be more encouraging for us to go to a conference of business leaders, not telling us how successful they've become playing the system, but giving us advice on how to move forward and how to change the way we think, and to encourage us more to develop a new idea of how the world's going to run itself. I think that is the challenge for our generation.
And socially and morally conscientious.
Well, and you know, that's not only very well said, but I just want the both of you to know, both you, Kevin, and Samantha, that when we have people like you on the show, young people who are obviously as brilliant and as engaged as you are, it gives me great hope for the future, because there are a lot of big problems out there, but obviously there are a lot of brilliant, dedicated, engaged people to deal with those things. So thanks so much for being on the show. I hope if both of you get to Horace's again next year, that we get a chance to sit down and talk and have you on the show again.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, continued success, both of you.
Yeah. And now we're going to... All right, see ya. And now we're going to leave you with a song for Mother's Day. And I picked this song. It's corny as corny can be, but it's a real life story. It was written by Dolly Parton about his mother, about her mother, I'm sorry. And it just shows that the women in our lives, our mothers especially, do everything they can to take whatever we're given and make the very best of it and give us all great lives. So if you haven't hugged your mother, called your mother, kissed your mother today, please do it, because they really are the thing that makes us great in life. So thanks, and we'll see you next week. And thank you, Maria Sanchez.
Thank you, Senator Michael D. Brown. It was wonderful.
Yeah, we'll see you. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.